You know, we often think we've got a pretty good handle on things like diversity, equity, inclusion. We hear these terms all the time. But what if there's more going on? Deeper layers, maybe unseen forces shaping how we interact that we don't always talk about. Welcome to the deep dive. We pull out the key insights from stacks of sources, basically giving you a shortcut to being really well informed. Today, we're digging into what diversity, equity, and inclusion really mean and why they're so vital. We're drawing from this great chapter focused on civility and cultural competence.
Right. And our mission today really is to unpack how certain voices, diverse voices, have historically been kind of pushed aside or ignored. We want to broaden our view of all the surprising ways people identify, beyond the usual categories. And we'll get into some crucial ideas like implicit bias and privilege, things that operate under the surface, the
Right.
goal, to help you navigate assumptions, maybe those awkward microaggressions, and really build towards genuine inclusivity. Hopefully you'll walk away with more than just facts, maybe a new way of seeing things.
That's exactly it. This deep dive is all about getting those aha moments, cutting through all the noise online and helping you build a real understanding without getting totally overwhelmed.
Yeah, and the source gives us a powerful starting point. It says, historically, however, not all contributions and voices have been acknowledged equal or adequately. So we'll start there. Looking at how this played out in American life, civic stuff, education, culture, and importantly, how those old patterns still echo today.
Okay, let's unpack that. Our sources, they immediately point out this big contradiction, right? The US calls itself a melting pot nation of immigrants, but like you said, not everyone's contributions got the same recognition. And this isn't just some dusty history note. It's like the blueprint for inequalities that still affect us. It shows how deliberate the exclusion could be.
And what's really striking is just how wide-ranging and frankly how brutal the historical mistreatment was. We're talking entire populations having to fight not just for fairness, but for basic dignity, basic participation in society. I mean, think about the forced removal of Native Americans, the Trail of Tears that was over 1,000 miles, more than 10,000 people died. It's staggering. And then came forced assimilation right up until the 1970s. Kids taken from their families, sent to schools where they couldn't speak their languages, couldn't practice their traditions. Huge cultural loss there.
That's just, it shows how deep these roots go, really deep.
And then you have 250 years of slavery. So much of the U.S.'s early wealth was built on the unpaid labor of African Americans, absolutely none of it benefiting them. That then shifted into the Jim Crow era, actual laws segregating everything, schools, buses, hospitals, parks, restaurants, whites-only signs, separate entrances. And our source notes this affected Mexican Americans and Catholics, too, in various ways.
Right. And it wasn't only these huge, long-lasting systems. The sources also mention Japanese Americans interned during World War II, just based on fear during wartime.
Precisely. And we absolutely have to talk about the exclusion of women and minority men, just shut out of public life, government, industry, cultural places. Think about this. The Supreme Court, founded 1789, the first female justice, Sandra Day O'Connor, 1981. That's almost 200 years later.
Wow. Nearly 200 years.
Yeah. Or Jackie Robinson breaking the color barrier in baseball in 1947. The major leagues were established way back in 1869, decades later. These weren't accidents. They were structural barriers, built-in disadvantages.
So, thinking about today, how do these historical things, these patterns, still kind of subtly create unfairness now, even if the explicit laws are gone?
That's the key question, isn't it? For you, the listener, to really think about. These historical examples weren't random acts. They were based on legal discrimination, unfair treatment. And it highlights the incredible courage it took to make change. The civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s, the women's rights movement in the 70s, they often had to use protest, direct action to fight these ingrained practices. And the legacy of that struggle, it definitely shapes our civic life today and the ongoing need for policies that actually monitor bias, that aim for real equity.
Okay, so shifting gears a bit. When we talk diversity, usually, race, gender, maybe age comes to mind first, the things we can often see. But this chapter really pushes us beyond that, right? It shows diversity is way more complex, much more intricate than just what's on the surface.
Exactly. The source is really clear. Diversity includes so many unseen aspects of identity. Beyond the obvious stuff, it paints this picture of a really rich tapestry of categories shaping our viewpoints. Things like sexual orientation, political views, even veteran status. The full list they give is pretty eye-opening. Age, socioeconomic factors, ability like sight, hearing, mobility, ethnicity, veteran status, where you're from geographically, language, sexual orientation, religion, even body size.
That is a much bigger picture than I think most people usually hold in their heads.
Absolutely. And social psychologists actually break down identity in a few ways to help us understand it better. First, there's personal identity. That's what makes you uniquely you. Your specific life experiences. Mm. No two people are identical, right?
Yeah.
Then there's role identity. This is about how we act in different situations. You might be a boss at work, but then a collaborator in a class or a parent at home. Your role changes. How people see you changes.
Okay. And what about connecting with groups?
That's social identity. It's about how we see ourselves in relation to certain groups. Maybe identifying as, say, Korean American or a Chicagoan or a Methodist or even a huge Lakers fan. These identities shape our public lives, who we connect with. And finally, collective identity. This is when groups form around a shared cause or belief, like the energy behind the hashtag MeToo movement or, you know, dedicated fan groups like Trekkies.
What I found really fascinating here was this idea of fluidity and intersectionality. The chapter quotes Walt Whitman, "I am large, I contain multitudes." It really emphasizes that our identities aren't fixed, they change, they overlap, sometimes they might even seem contradictory, they definitely don't fit neatly into boxes.
Which brings up a really interesting question for you, the listener. How do you react when someone's identity doesn't fit your neat categories, when it kind of challenges your assumptions? The chapter talks about gender fluidity and non-binary identities moving beyond just male or female. It highlights this huge range of possible expression. They mention actor Asia Kate Dillon, the first openly non-binary actor in a major TV show. And there's this anecdote about a reporter struggling to describe Dillon to a restaurant manager because they just didn't fit the usual descriptions. It also mentions how language itself is evolving, right? With self-chosen labels like genderqueer and pronouns like her, z, m, x becoming more common, even getting into dictionaries.
So it's not static.
Yes.
Language and acceptance are constantly evolving.
Precisely. Mm. And that leads us to intersectionality. This term was coined by legal scholar Kimberly Crenshaw back in 1989. She used it to explain how, for example, the experience of Black women wasn't just about being Black plus being a woman treated separately. It was a unique, combined experience of both race and gender that couldn't be pulled apart. It's not like puzzle pieces fitting together. It's more like threads woven into a single cloth. Their experience is distinct because of that combination.
That's a really important distinction. You can't just isolate one part of someone's identity and think you understand their whole experience.
Exactly. And that's the core takeaway from intersectionality. Never assume everyone in a particular group thinks or feels the same way. People are way more complex than any single label. Their overlapping identities create these really unique perspectives. We see this playing out right now in debates, like the discussion around the term Latinx. Is it more inclusive than Latina-Latina? Some people within that community actually argue against using it, which just highlights that there's no single voice for any large group.
Okay, so if diversity is this complex and our identities are layered and fluid, how do we even begin to navigate our own perceptions? This brings us to those two really key, often invisible forces, implicit bias and privilege.
Yeah, and what's so interesting, maybe even a bit unsettling, is that even if we want to be fair, even if we truly believe in equality, our brains have these mental shortcuts that can, well, lead us astray. Implicit bias, the definition given by Handelsman and Sacherny, is helpful here. It's about unconscious, implicit assumptions that influence their judgments and perceptions of others. These biases get shaped by, you know, a whole lifetime of experiences, cultural messages, and they pop up as expectations based on stereotypes, race, gender, age, whatever. And the crucial part is this. People who intend to be fair and believe they are egalitarian apply biases unintentionally. This can actually harm things like workforce quality, create unfair situations, often without anyone consciously meaning to.
Wow. So even if I'm actively trying not to be biased, these unconscious things might still be influencing me. That's a tough one to grapple with.
It really is.
Yeah.
And the chapter even points out how things like online algorithms can sometimes narrow our exposure to different views, which can actually reinforce the biases we already have. It mentions Harvard's Project Implicit website. You can actually go online and take tests there to measure your own unconscious preferences. It can be pretty eye-opening.
Okay, let's talk privilege then. A lot of people hear that word and, you know, they immediately jump to money or race. Sometimes it feels like an accusation. But the chapter really broadens that definition, doesn't it? It moves beyond just those obvious things.
Right. If we look at the bigger picture, privilege is basically a right or exemption granted as a special benefit or advantage. It's the flip side of oppression, which is described as the use of institutional privilege and power, where one person or group benefits at the expense of another.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the part that might surprise people. The source makes a point that everyone has a certain amount of privilege, too.
Everyone. How does that work? Can you give some examples?
Sure. Think about height privilege. If you're around average height, you probably don't think twice about reaching stuff on a high shelf in a store or adjusting your car seat easily. That convenience, that's a small privilege or wealth privilege. Not having constant economic stress, being able to save for retirement, living in a safe area, affording private school maybe. There's education privilege too. A college degree takes hard work, absolutely, but it often opens doors to better jobs, higher earning potential. It grants an advantage, even with the effort involved. Now, the source brings up Malcolm Gladwell's story again about how changing his hair length affected how people perceived his race, leading to different treatment, like getting stopped by police more often. A subtle but powerful example of white privilege in action.
Okay, so if we all have privilege in some areas, what's the takeaway? Is it about feeling guilty, or is it something more constructive?
The main message is really important. It is no one's fault that they may have privilege in any given situation. Guilt isn't really the point. The goal is not to exploit privilege, but to share it. So think practically. Maybe making a real effort to be inclusive when you're hiring, or putting together a study group, mentoring a student who seems isolated, maybe speaking up on an issue when others might be afraid to, donating to causes you believe in. It's about using whatever advantages you have to consciously try and level the playing field for others.
Okay, that makes sense. So how do we take all this understanding, implicit bias, privilege, and actually apply it day to day? The chapter offers two really concrete strategies: actively avoiding assumptions and being mindful of microaggressions.
Yeah, and this brings up a key question for you, the listener. How can really understanding assumptions and microaggressions help you look at situations, maybe evaluate statements you hear, and try to avoid causing offense unintentionally? The source warns that just relying on surface clues, like how someone looks or talks, leads straight to stereotyping. And stereotyping robs people of their individual identities. Prejudging someone prejudiced, it basically turns them into an object, a category, instead of seeing the complex person they are.
The examples the chapter gives are pretty striking because they show how assumptions, even ones that seem positive on the surface, can still end up blocking opportunities.
It's exactly. Like, a hiring manager assumes an Asian American candidate must be good at math and hires them over a Hispanic applicant based purely on that stereotype. That's not fair, even if it seemed like a compliment. Or a teacher automatically picks an Indian American kid for the spelling bee team just because past winners were Indian American. Or even a coach defaulting to a white male student for quarterback just because, well, historically that's been the norm. These assumptions, even the seemingly positive ones, effectively block chances for people who don't fit the expected mold. It really underlines why we need things like diverse internship programs or diverse hiring committees. And it happens in small ways too, right? Like assuming why someone is interested in a particular topic. The source stresses that actively practicing assumption avoidance really builds your cultural competency.
Okay, and then there are microaggressions. That word's definitely more common now, but I still think maybe the impact gets underestimated sometimes.
Oh, absolutely. The definition provided is acts of insensitivity that reveal our inherent biases, cultural incompetency, and hostility towards someone outside of our community. And these can be based on any diversity, variable age, religion, ability, not just race or gender, the impact. The person on the receiving end is reminded of the barriers to complete acceptance and understanding. It causes pain and invalidation. And if it happens over and over, there's this compounding effect. It just wears people down.
Like that example with Anne and her boss in the cafeteria.
Right. Anne's laughing with coworkers and her boss says, "Anne, this isn't a night at one of your clubs. Quiet down." Ooh. The boss implied something negative about Anne, maybe her background, maybe her social life. And Anne felt totally humiliated. But here's the kicker. The boss might not have meant to be offensive. They might have thought they were being funny or just direct. This is crucial. The speaker often has no idea. They might even think they're being nice. But times change, attitudes change, language changes. So thinking before speaking is just essential.
Yeah, the examples in the source really hit home. They show how these small comments can just completely invalidate someone's reality.
For sure. Like, related to educational status, asking, did they have honors classes at your high school? It subtly suggests maybe you're less prepared because of where you came from.
For race, ethnicity, things like, you speak so well for someone like you, I mean, wow, the implication is that people of that race normally don't speak well, or that classic, know where are you really from? It instantly makes someone feel like an outsider, even if they were born and raised right here.
And for gender identity, comments like, oh, I guess you can't make the meeting tonight. You have to watch your son. It just assumes a parent, often a mother, can't manage both.
Right. Or saying, look, I don't get all this pronoun stuff, so I'm just going to call you what I call you. That completely dismisses the importance of someone's identity.
Even something that sounds like a compliment, maybe. You're too good looking to be so smart. It links appearance and ability in this really weird diminishing way.
Right.
These aren't just slips of the tongue. They carry weight. And you see it with sexual orientation, too. Like, wow, you seem pretty rugged for a gay guy. That just plays into tired stereotypes. Or for age, that dismissive, okay, boomer, it just writes off a whole generation. And for ability, telling someone in a wheelchair, man, I wish I could just sit down wherever I went. It frames their wheelchair as some kind of luxury, totally ignoring the challenges.
Yeah.
All of these, even if you don't mean harm, they show a lack of empathy, right? A failure to really consider the other person's perspective.
Wow. Okay, that was a really comprehensive deep dive. We went all the way from these huge historical injustices down to the really subtle everyday interactions that shape our world, how we see each other.
Indeed. And if we pull back to the big picture again, the chapter leaves us with this thought. Eternal vigilance is the price of civility. Like liberty, right?
Yeah.
Civility isn't something you achieve and then you're done. It needs constant work, constant attention, adapting as society changes. We can't just get complacent.
So what does this mean for you, the listener, practically speaking? Whether you're starting a career, still in school, or just living your life in your community, cultural competency isn't just nice to have. It feels pretty essential.
Absolutely. And the chapter offers some really powerful, concrete ways to build that competency.
Mm-hmm.
Things like traveling, even just locally. See how other people live. Try to understand their world. Learn another language if you can.
Yeah.
Actively look for resources, maybe projects in your community that promote civility. And if you notice diversity is missing somewhere, like in a class syllabus or just in a conversation, use that as a trigger, an opportunity to do your own research, broaden your horizons, look up contributions by underrepresented folks in your field, find academic groups focused on diversity. And if you actually hear prejudice, the advice is blunt. If you hear something, say something. Don't let hate speech slide by pretending it's just academic freedom. One silences, the other should invite discussion.
Yeah. Ultimately, this deep dive really shows that understanding diversity, being culturally competent, it's not just about ticking boxes or avoiding saying the wrong thing or just being sensitive. It's deeper than that.
Right. Which leads to maybe one final question for you to think about after we wrap up. How could cultivating your own cultural competency actually do more than just improve your own interactions or career? How might it actively contribute to building a better, genuinely more inclusive future for everyone?